Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Michael Mullaney, and he'll be answering your most important questions on stripping for stripers. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking more with Michael about stripping for stripers. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Chart will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish, big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051. Or go to the website www.flatstime.com. That's flatstime.com. Well, before we introduce Michael, we'd like to let you know about some of the great gifts we have to give away tonight. And for our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Michael's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll be announcing the winners at the end of the show. Well, tonight our guest is Michael Mullaney. Michael started his fly fishing career on the Delaware River in Pennsylvania at the helm of a drift boat, working at New Hope Outfitters in Bucks County from 1996 to 2001. He learned to tie caddis flies and handle the 5 and 6 weight fly rods. Aiming for smallmouth bass on the river, he mastered his ability on wet and dry fly presentations. In 2002, Michael moved to the mountain streams of western Massachusetts. He worked at Greenfield Outfitters for 2 years, taking people fishing on the Green, Millers, Deerfield, Sawmill, and Connecticut rivers. On these rivers, Michael honed his skill on native brook trout, rainbow, and brown trout action, with Atlantic salmon as well. In 2003, Michael moved to Cape Cod and formed the Brown Dog Fishing Guides, a professional guide service. Michael also created a publishing company called Cape Cod Maritime Guide, which focuses on maritime activities, including fly fishing. Michael has guided for several TV shows, including Orvis, ESPN in 2002, OLN versus Cabela's in 2005, and for Greenfield Community Television in 2003. Michael is a polished fly casting instructor and is also a fly tier with experience in choosing color and size flies specifically for Cape Cod. Michael, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hi, Roger. I'm excited to be here.
Michael, good to have you on the show. We're going to cover a lot of things tonight, as usual, and we're going to be focusing in on the Cape Cod area with striped bass, and that'll be our primary focus tonight. Talk a little bit about the fish itself, the seasons there in that area, and how we locate stripers out in the surf and the deeper water, as well as equipment, and going to spend quite a bit of time on presentation and strategy, because what we're going to learn here is there's a lot of ways to go after the stripers up in that area. So lots of things to talk about. So let's get started here, Michael. First of all, why don't you give us just kind of an overview of what the Cape Cod fishery is like and what it's like fishing around there. So those of us that may not have been there before can get a mental picture of Cape Cod.
Well, Cape Cod is a peninsula that extends out from the Massachusetts border approximately 60 to 90 miles, depending on if you're at Chatham or you're going all the way up to P-Town. The north side of the Cape is referred to as Cape Cod Bay. The south side of the Cape is referred to Nantucket Sound. The eastern outer beaches is the Atlantic, and nothing stops you going all the way to Paris, right to the Atlantic Ocean. So it's a peninsula surrounded by three sides of water, and the Cape is actually split from the mainland by the Cape Cod Canal, which is a man-made canal that, so you could call us an island if you'd like, but most people refer to us as a peninsula.
And what is the, you know, you mentioned Nantucket Sound there as well as the bay. I assume those are two different kinds of fisheries.
Yeah, Nantucket Sound is the south part of the Cape, and the reason they call it Nantucket Sound is obvious because Nantucket Island is south on the south part, and then and as well as Martha's Vineyard. On the north side, they call it Cape Cod Bay, obviously because it kind of wraps around the border of Massachusetts between the end of the peninsula, which is Provincetown. The Cape also has 14 towns to it, and in each town, there's at least two or three harbors to each town. So the Cape is just all about water, water everywhere you want to be. And the interesting part about it, depending on where the wind's blowing, you can, you know, have decent fishing. If the wind's blowing from the north or from the east or from the west, we can always switch to either side and be in the lee side of the wind, and that makes for extensive fly fishing opportunity pretty much all season long.
Okay, so there are striped bass on both sides, or all around the Cape, then, is what you're telling us.
Yes, the striped bass are definitely on all sides of the Cape. They are, you know, they migrate in certain parts of the year, and it's just fantastic fishing all around.
Well, tell us a little bit about the life cycle of the striped bass. You said, you know, that you just mentioned migrations and so forth. What, where do they come from, and how long do they stay? And
yeah, most of the biologists have, and the studies, there's rivers that go down the eastern seaboard of the United States, all the way down to, say, like Roanoke, Virginia, to the Potomac, to the Delaware River, the Chesapeake Bay region, all the way up to Cape Cod. The majority of the species of striped bass that are studied and tagged are coming from the Chesapeake Bay area. There is a large population of stripers that also come from the Hudson River as well. The stripers migrate, and they are an endogamous species, and they will breed in fresh water at certain times of the year. We can get into that the striper stuff a little later. As far as the winter grounds versus the spring grounds and that kind of stuff.
Okay, so they do move through your area then? I mean, they're not always there all the time? Is that the situation?
Absolutely. The striped bass are definitely a migrating species of fish, and they will come up the eastern seaboard in the spring and then come back down the eastern seaboard in the fall.
Okay. So you have kind of two seasons there then.
Well, the stripers, I mean, their spawning cycle is actually in the late winter, the March and April, and they will go up the rivers, whether it's Roanoke or Potomac or Hudson or Delaware. They're going to go up into the fresh water and do their spawning cycle in the late winter, and then they're going to move out into the ocean. Obviously, that's the endogamous, you know, the biologists call that endogamous species of fish. And as they migrate northward, as the water temperature rises and they're going for cooler water and they're following the bait fish patterns and all the other stuff, they're going to come up into to our region.
Okay. And about what time do they arrive then in the Cape Cod area?
They arrive March. The first smaller fish arrive in March. The stripers will, March, April, May, they'll start coming up, depending on where they were born. The striper lives, all up and down the East Coast, and they grow, about 4 to 6 inches per year. And the little ones that are a year old can travel all the way up, to our area from the Chesapeake, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So what? How big do stripers get, and what's an average size? Would you say?
The biggest stripers on the sport fishing records came up actually on the New Jersey coast. It was a 78-pound striper on the New Jersey shore. On Cape Cod, the biggest striper came off of Nauset Beach in 1983, and I believe that was 73 pounds.
And what's your average fish on any given day?
For fly fishing angling?
Yeah, for fly fishing.
For fly fishing, we are usually in the 25-inch to 40-inch range.
And what is that in weight?
And those fish can range from, say, 4 pounds all the way to 20 pounds.
And is there anything out there chasing the stripers around?
That's
food source?
That is an amazing question. I mean, just in the last week, we've had great white sightings off of Chatham. Chatham is the elbow of the Cape. If you think of a peninsula going out straight out to the Atlantic and then making kind of a curve up northward and going all the way up to Peatown, the elbow is Chatham, and we have a seal population in Chatham. The seals hang on the beach, and from Peatown all the way down to Chatham, we've got estimated 6,500 seals that are in there. And just as of last week, a surfer was out there and watched a seal devoured by a great white. Great whites, pilot whales, seals will all take stripers. One time I was up fishing on the jetty in Provincetown, and I was casting my fly rod and using a popper fly. And I was stripping the fly back, a bluefish, you know, screaming off, my line was screaming off the reel. And all of a sudden, it even went out faster. And I was taken back by that. And all of a sudden, I'm like, there's something wrong here. I must be snagged with a boat or something like that. And I look up about 50 yards out, and a seal is shaking his head with my bluefish that I stuck in his head, looking at me like, I'm taking this fish, and you can't have it. So it's
you slowed it down a bit for him, I take it, huh?
Yeah. that was interesting.
Yeah. Now, are stripers good to eat? Or are they good?
Absolutely.
To eat?
They're definitely a type of fish that you would definitely put on the table for dinner. Sure.
Okay.
The scientific name for stripers is Morone sextalis. It's also known as a lockfish in Maryland. They're also called line sliders. They're called squid hounds. Some people call them greenheads. They're a greenish, bluish type of fish with lines going across its body on the lateral lines of the fish. And it has a spiky dorsal fin. It has a very large mouth with no teeth. So you can kind of lip them when you're taking them in. And, it's kind of like sandpaper. It feels like sandpaper on your fingers. If you're lipping the fish, it does have a gill plate, so the bigger fish can cut your line off with the gill plate if you let them. So you got to watch out your hands on the gill plate; they're all a little sharp there. But in general, you can manage these stripers, without worrying about toothy critter type of stuff.
And going back to seasons. We had a couple of questions, one from John Larson in California, wanting to know the most productive months to fly fish for stripers from the beach. So he's being kind of specific there. I don't know if that makes much difference, but does it? As far
you
as
mean the time of the year to the best time of year to fish for stripers?
Yeah, from the
oh,
beach
you mean just,
he
just,
was being...
Just beaching. Oh, yeah, beach fishing. Well... Cape Cod is a interesting place. From Chatham all the way up on the eastern side of the peninsula, it goes up to Provincetown. In 1972, the Kennedys actually preserved the whole outer beaches in a federal act. And you can't build on the outer beaches, but in some portions of it, you can drive. So there is a nuance and an art to Cape Cod fishing the outer beaches. For example, if you're looking down the beach, and you're looking for points of interest. You know, obviously there's an outcropping of land. That would represent some sort of structure where fish would be. There's also bowls that are indentations in beach fishing. And there's also washout areas. and there's also sandbars, which tide will move across the sandbar or diagonally from the sandbar that will hold stripers.
Well, but what John was asking was, is there better times of year, better months to fish from the beach? Like, does the weather play a role or tides or anything in time of year? Or is it just as good from the beach any time that the stripers are in?
Okay, in the fall is the time for the largest stripers. On the annual migration southward, the stripers are fed up all year long. And there is a big tournament called the Martha's Vineyard Derby that's been around for 70 years. And during that time, it's when the fish are feeding up and they're moving back south into the warmer waters, and that's when they're at the biggest as far as time. As far as tide, and as the question would be, what's the best time to fish for stripers on the beach? That's an interesting question. I like the incoming tide, about as the tide's starting to switch, 2 hours before the incoming tide. Another way to fish on the beach is if you're just kind of hanging out and you get your binoculars in your truck, or you're going up and down, you're looking for bird activity, you're looking for, it could be just one fluttering bird that's going to be diving down into the beach, and that'll give you a signal or a clue to what's going on. But that incoming tide pushing in to a beach or a jetty is when the game species are pushing bait into the up into the beaches for sure.
Okay. Another question about time of year was just what if you could pit, and actually there's two, Rick B. in Erie, Pennsylvania asked a similar question. But one of the questions was what would be the optimum month of the year, and then what Rick was asking is what would be the best weekend of the year to go up for stripers?
Oh, geez.
If you can narrow it down.
I would say for fly fishing, June is an amazing month.
June, okay.
On the Cape. For some reason, in June, it's like all the waters are very cold. The estuaries are colder temperature, and all the fish are closest to the beach in June compared to July, August, and September. June is the quintessential fly fishing month on Cape Cod for sure.
Okay, and that's kind of what he said. Rick said that he and some friends made a trip up the Cape the first week in June this year and did quite well, although most of the fish were in the 24-inch size. We fished both sides and some of the estuaries, so sounds like he was there at a good time. Well, what about weather conditions that influence fishing? You mentioned the incoming tide, but is it better on a clear day, on a cloudy day?
It's all good. The weather, as far as wind, is predominantly from the southwest. On Cape Cod, and that means it's coming from the Vineyard, which is the island south of the Cape, and Nantucket, and it's coming up from the southwest predominantly. When the wind shifts coming from the north is usually when there's a little lull in activity, as far as when you're on the boats and all that other stuff. As far as light conditions and, on high sun days, I have a great time catching stripers. I like to use the natural colors flies, like olives and flies that will blend in with the sand or blend in with grass line. If we're on a cloudy day or we've got some water that might be a little tainted, I'll use chartreuses and pinks that'll light up, and that seems to work a little better. But as far as light conditions, it's not that big a deal. What's really important on the Cape Cod, and I have to like really talk about it. This is moving water. As the tides change, either the incoming or the outgoing, it's very important that people realize that's the best time for feeding activity. The water, as it moves in and out, it'll create action in the water and it'll stir up the bait fish and push them in areas where maybe they don't want to be in. And the stripers are definitely feeding off of tidal activity for sure.
Okay, well, Michael, let's hold that thought for just a second. We need to take a little break, and let's talk, when we come back, we'll talk more about that, okay, about the tides and the moving water. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of the only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like shortline nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Michael Mullaney about stripping for stripers. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Michael, before we get back to the moving water and so forth, because I know everybody's going to want to hear about that. That's the real nuts and bolts of this. Tell us a little bit about your business, what you do there, what services you provide for fly fishers.
Well, the business accommodates fly fishing guests and clients, either kayaking, flat-style boat, center console boat, offshore rigs, wet wading, or surf casting on the jetties and the beaches. We try to offer, the unique part of the Cape, we have estuaries, we have bay fishing, we've got beach fishing, we've got fishing on the rips and the shoals. Rips and shoal fishings, especially on the Nantucket Sound side is an amazing way to catch stripers and to know the rips and to know the tides that go off these different shoals, is definitely an important aspect of fishing. And we have 12 guides on our staff that can accommodate people for any of those type of fly fishing excursions.
Okay, would you want to tell us what your website name is?
We're at CapeCodFlyFishing.com, and anybody that surfs that site can get a little feel for what we do.
Okay.
Which is a varied approach to fly fishing. On Cape, we've got, pretty much any type of fly fishing that you can imagine, especially when you're talking about stripping for stripers, we start wet wading on the beaches or the estuaries, and that entails sight fishing for fish, for stripers in the 25 to 40 inch range. People can sight fish for them. Stripers can act like redfish or bonefish. They move in pods. They can also, tail on top of the water and root around, for crabs and sand eels and mummy chugs and all different type of baits, including squid and herring and menhaden. Stripers eat all those types of fish. Starting in the estuaries and moving out into the beaches, a lot of the estuaries / rivers on the Cape, there's probably 15 very, very decent estuaries on Cape Cod that any fly fishing enthusiast could come over and check out. And then we start fishing the beaches, and then going out past the beaches, we start talking about the shoals. A shoal is a level of sand that comes up say you're like in Nantucket Sound, maybe 3 or 4 miles off the shore, and you've got a shoal, which is a structure of land that comes up underneath the sea. And at low tide, you can actually see the sand there, and the fish will stack up on the sides of the shoal and wait for bay fish that are going to get washed through the tides as the tides are moving back and forth from the shoal. On the south side of Cape Cod, there are shoals from Monomoy Island towards Nantucket. Some of them are, the most famous ones that we fish are Bursa Shoal, Handkerchief Shoal, the rips on the end of Monomoy. If you're on the bay side, on the top of Cape Cod, we'll fish Billingsgate Shoal, which is very popular, on the boats. You're talking rip type of fishing, where you can fly fish for stripers. They will tail on top of the water say you're like 4 or 5 miles offshore. They will do that, for sure. If the stripers are down a little bit lower, we'll get into the 300 grain sinking type of stuff.
So basically, what you're telling me is that when the stripers are around, they could be just about anywhere from within 3 feet of water to 80 feet of water.
Yeah, literally, that's amazing. I was talking to one of the captains, and we have Robbie Briggs here, by the way, who's one of my charter captains, that I'd love for him to get involved in this conversation. But I was talking to one of my other charter captains the other day, and he was diamond jigging at 120 feet of water 3 miles off of Chatham and catching 40-inch stripers left and right. He caught 40 or 50 of those in about a two-hour stretch, and they were at 120 feet of water. And then in that same day...
A little deep for fly fishing, though, right?
Well, no, but check this out, Roger. In that same day in Pleasant Bay, which is only 3 miles across the barrier beach in Chatham, we're fishing and catching 40-inch striper in 3 feet of water. So to answer, that's pretty amazing when you're you know, getting the same fish in 3 feet of water versus the jigging guys that are getting the same fish in 120 feet of water. That's pretty cool.
Yeah,
and on
it
the
is.
Fly rod. And on the fly rod to boot.
Yeah, because it's, you know, a lot of times, depending on the types of fish, you'll find, you know, larger fish deeper, and sometimes that prohibits you from catching them on a fly rod, you know, because it's just the mechanics of getting the fly down to those levels is just too difficult. But that's nice that you can catch a good-sized fish in shallow water, and it sounds like, you know, what we're talking about here is that a person going out there can satisfy their need in a lot of different ways, you know, whether it be wading or whether it be from a kayak or a flat-style boat and so forth. So that's rather nice. Well, so do we have Robbie on the line now? Are you there, Robbie?
Hey, how are you doing tonight?
There, good. Hi, Robbie. Well, welcome. Robbie, you're one of the guides for Michael there, and we're closely with him. Let's talk about fishing from the beach and doing a wading type fishing there. Can you kind of fill us in on some of your tactics that you use when guiding people on first of all, sighting and locating fish from the beach, and then approaching them, and what's your presentation like?
Okay. As far as I, because it's dependent, I know Michael's talked about all our different bodies of water that we have here, so there's
right.
a lot of different techniques. On the outer beaches, you have a lot of water that might be as deep as 20 feet, just, 100 feet off the beach, and you're looking for something different there. There you're looking for your sloughs or a sandbar that'll create a hole in near the beach. And all these techniques come with, you know, experience, and of course that's why you hire a guide. But with a little practice, I mean, anyone can do this. Springtime fishing on the south side in Nantucket Sound, squid is and herring are the main baits there, and we fish a lot of jetties. Any of the rivers, most every river has a herring run.
Let's get back to fishing the beaches, and you said that, you know, you're looking for little holes or pockets of water where these fish are laid up in. Are the fish moving up the beach then?
Oh, yes. The fish move back and forth in the surf zone. They'll go up and down the beach chasing the bait. Depending on what the bait is, they'll root for sand eels in the quieter water and you'll actually catch fish with their bottom jaw is all red from where they've been pushing around in the sand trying to force the sand eels out of the bottom. You can get those, the flats, they're doing the same thing when the tide comes in. They're up there looking for those sand eels.
Okay. Now, if we're working down the beach, are we looking for fish? Are we looking for surface activity? Are we sight fishing? How are we finding these fish?
You're gonna find them. One of the best days I ever had was actually a lone bird that wasn't even diving in the water, but was flying back and forth across up and down the surf about a half a mile distance back and forth. And it took me a while to dawn on me. I saw a fish break underneath the bird, but the fish weren't in a surface feeding mode, but just watching that bird, and you know, it took me to see a fish. It was too early in the day. It was like about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and the sun was still up, and every book will tell you, it was way too early to catch stripers, and yet, you know, there they were, and they were actually trading. There was a sandbar that came into the beach at a very shallow angle, so it created a small pocket at the end where it joined the beach, and then it got wider as it went out, it almost that half a mile length. It was called Longbow, was the name we called it then. That's all changed now. That was a few years ago. And our outer beaches have changed quite a bit in the last few years with different openings. But still, that happens everywhere. You'll have that sandbar that comes in to join the beach, and you'll have an area of deep water right in front of the beach. And the fish will get the bait up in there and kind of trap them against that sandbar and in that surf. When the surf's breaking over the sandbar, the bait can't hold in that water, and that's exactly what the stripers are looking for. It's someplace they can take advantage of their size to push through that heavy water.
Well, then, Art, you said the bird gave you an indication that there were fish in the area. Then as you got closer, can you actually see the fish? Are you sight fishing to them?
That day, everything was correct, the sun angle and everything. I could see right into the waves as they were coming into on the beach, and it wasn't a real rough day. It was about a 2-foot surf coming in, but it was enough. You could look right in the water and see the stripers there. And, of course, that's pretty exciting. And other times, if you have the surf roiled up or if the light's not correct, you can't see them. But, you'll see them roll every once in a while on something, especially, like, right up in the wash. I find a lot of people think they have to cast that line way out. And, in fact, that just at the edge of the wash is just as good a place to catch a big striper as anywhere.
Okay. So water depth doesn't make a lot of difference. It's more the structure that they can work to trap bait fish that makes a bigger
exactly
difference.
Right. They want that water being roiled up where the bait fish can't, they don't have the size and bulk to control themselves in that sort of a tumbling action that the waves get when they crash on the beach like that. And the same way as they break over a sandbar. Anywhere that water is being, the stripers can take advantage of that big broad tail they have to push them through the water where the bait can't do that.
Talked about different depths that you can find, and basically any depth we're able to find these fish. What about temperature of the water out there? Is there a difference? Do they prefer colder water, warmer water? Does it make a difference?
It does make a difference. What we have in Mike talked about June here being one of the better months for fly fishing on the Cape, and Nantucket Sound shines in June. That's when all the bait come in. The herring are in the rivers. The squid are out a little bit more offshore. All these shoals and areas we have, very good. But the trouble is Nantucket Sound is very shallow. It's 40 feet deep at the deepest. If you drew a line from, say, Hyannis in the Mid-Cape area over to Nantucket, it's 40 feet deep is about it. So it warms up quickly. When the temperature gets put up to about 68 degrees, the stripers move from that area. That's when they go for the colder water. They'll head down towards Chatham. We have the ocean influence and the much colder water coming in. I was going to say, even a week ago, I was off in the area between the end of Monomoy and Nantucket on Handkerchief Shoals, and there's a lot of different areas. Now, there's places out there where, without the tide, I mean, it's only 3 or 4 feet deep, and I catch a lot of stripers where it's only 6 to 8 feet deep. And there, you can see them, as you drift through that rip, you can see the fish in the water, and you know right, on the edge of that rip line, again, it's that water tumbling where the big fish can't control itself. But I was out last week, and I actually hit a pocket of water that was only 51 degrees.
So they're liking, are you saying they're liking the colder water over the warmer water?
Yes, they like the cooler water. You very seldom will you find stripers in the summertime now where the water temperature is well above 70 in Nantucket Sound along all of beaches and everything. Very rarely will you find stripers there. They'll all be out towards the colder water. They definitely prefer. I think myself, optimum temperature is between 58 and 68.
Okay. We talked about, Michael.
Hey, Rod.
All right, let's talk about time of day, Michael. How that plays a role in locating stripers. Is
well,
there a better time of day?
Well, this is how I do it. Say I'm hanging out in a bait shop or a tackle shop on the Cape, and there's 14 towns on the Cape. There's probably 18 different tackle shops that you can go to. Every tackle shop has a tide chart. So any enthusiasts, especially a fly fishing enthusiast that are coming to Cape Cod, definitely pick up a tide chart. because when the moving water, either on the ebb or the flow of the tide, the high tide or the low tide, you definitely want to check out the tide chart. Moving water, structure, equals stripers.
Okay.
Now, structure would be a grass line. It could be like a shoal, like Robbie was talking about. It could be a point of land. For example, if you're in a bay and the outgoing tide is ripping across a point of land, the stripers like that, and they really like that. You just have to find those type of places. So again, this is the quintessential striper mantra: moving water, structure. Okay.
So are they sitting on the just on the other side of a point where the water's moving around, ready to ambush? Is that their intent?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And vice versa, the tidal switch going the other way, and they're going to sitting around and ambushing you on the other side of that. So if you're on a day fly fishing, you've got a no-win situation, you know. For example, if I'm on the north side of the Cape on the Brewster Flats, which is Dennis and Brewster, and the wind is blowing from the south, that's nirvana for me because I don't have any wind because Cape Cod is cutting the wind off from the south. If I want to go to Chatham, which is an interesting example, I might go over there because the wind is still coming from the southwest, and everybody's got to get their map out to check this out if they want to listen, go through this. But like, get a Cape Cod map right now and mark what I'm talking about, because if the south wind is blowing from the south and I'm either in Chatham or the north side, that's the lee side of the island or the peninsula, and that's nirvana for striper fishing. Now, when the wind switches to the north, everybody on the Cape Cod Bay side, whether they're fly fisher people or they're boat guys and jigging and trolling guys, are like, oh, the fish is, you know, not happening up there. Well, I kind of get a little chuckle in my mouth because I go to the south side and there's no wind and I'm in the estuaries or I'm on the beach and I can have a great day because I don't have any wind, and it's all on the fly rod as well. So
right.
I just switch around. I switch any whatever the wind is going, I go the opposite way for fly fishing.
Very good tip. Very good tip. And you're lucky you're able to do that where you're at. Some parts of the world, it doesn't work as nicely as that when the wind starts blowing.
Yeah, it's about a 20-minute drive, Roger. It's about a 20-minute drive either way.
Not bad.
You know, to get wherever you want to go.
Okay, we've got a question that came in over the internet here. Travis Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee. So he's been doing a lot of reading about stripers and came across that sight fishing for stripers at night under lights is hard to beat because the bait fish come up to feed. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Well, a full moon, you know. Hello, a full moon, you're out there. You can see and you can hear them slurping. You know, it's an interesting hatch is the worm hatch on the Cape. There's actually a worm hatch that goes off, and you can see the stripers slurping the worms down on top of the. They're not worms like the San Juan worm and out west. They're these different sandy worm things. They're kind of ugly things that these stripers eat. Now the stripers will also eat sand eels. Now believe it or not, these sand eels are sand lances. Some people call them. They live in the sand and they come out to eat zooplankton and all this other stuff at night. And the stripers will hone in off of that, or in the day or off the tide, but. As far as night fishing, when the sun goes down, the big stripers come out. That is a fact.
Can you fish under the lights? I know that, you know, a lot of people do this down in the Keys, you know, under the bridges.
Yes.
And because the tide's moving through the bridges nicely, just like what you've been describing, there's a lot of fish that stack up in there, and they do night fishing down there. So
this is the deal on Cape Cod with night fishing as far as fly fishing goes. From Provincetown, which is the tip of the Cape, and the tip is called Race Point. And as the water's moving over Race Point, it goes all the way down to Outer Beaches, all the way down to the Elbow, which is Chatham. All those outer beaches are available for fishing at night. You can buy a one-day pass or a three-day pass and fish the whole 40-mile stretch. And that is when you're going to get your nighttime fishing, for, you know, a 40, 50 pound striper. Because they're coming in, they're pushing all kinds of bait right up onto the beach. And, you know, I've seen it where you've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of bait fish jumping literally into the sand as the stripers are 2 feet off of the, off the beach, just going crazy. You can also, on sunny days, as the waves roll, well, this is really cool. When the waves roll, it's kind of like those rooster guys out on the Baja. When the waves roll, they see those rooster fish going through the tunnel like a surfer. Stripers
right.
will do the same thing. They'll run up and down the beach like a rooster fish does. And you can sight fish for them off the beach as well.
Sounds exciting. Well, Michael,
yeah.
we need to take a little break here. So give me 30 seconds, and I'll be right back to you, and we'll talk more about catching stripers. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide service to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Were you listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio? We're talking with Michael Mullaney about stripping for stripers. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Michael. Let's talk about equipment here for a few minutes. We've got a question that came in from Dwayne in Fairfax, Virginia. He says, I'm a Northern California trout fly fisherman. I moved to the Washington, D.C. area, and it looks like my Winston Boron 2X 8.5-foot 5 weight is not a perfect rod for stripers. What's your recommended first rod, length, weight, and so forth for stripers?
Great question. It's going to fish the estuaries, which is 2 feet of water. It's like rivers. Some people call them herring runs on the Cape. We're looking at 7 and 8 weights. And then if we're going a little bit offshore, we're going to the 9s and 10s. You don't really need anything more than that for stripers. As far as stripping for stripers, that's a great question. And we haven't even talked about that. This is the show. How about the stripping basket? The stripping basket is, you know, it goes in front of your body. The technique of stripping would be either hand over hand with the rod in your elbow close to your body, or you can turn the stripping basket to your side. And as you're stripping, this is an interesting technique, and I try to show this to my students and my clients all the time. As I strip, I'll tap the back of my stripping basket as it's on my side, on the side of my body. So what happens is I've got an 18-inch to, say, a 24-inch strip. So I'm stripped, strip, 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 and then I can rotate that either quick, 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 or slow strip, slow strip. Quick, 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 slow strip, slow strip. That's what the stripers want. They want a moving fly. They want something with action, and you want to, like, tap that back. If you're a hand-over-hand stripper, you're going to be in the front with the fly with close to your body again, and the rod pointed towards where the line's going out into the fish. You're going hand over hand and bringing it back. Quick, quick, quick. Just pause. Quick, quick, quick. Slow, boom, boom. And that's what they like.
Well, now, what kind of line are you using then? Using floating, sinking, intermediate? What do you use?
I use a floating line in the estuaries, something that's malleable and something that's laser straight. I like to buy, you know, decent fly lines. You don't want a fly line that's got any curls in it. I love to stretch my leaders out with my hand before I go fishing. I'll use class leaders in the, you know, 12-pound, 8-pound, all the way down to 6 or 4-pound. I will definitely straighten those leaders as I'm looking for stealthy stripers. The bigger fish, the stripers can live 20 years old, by the way. And some people say they live to 25 years old. A mature female striper can be at 4 years old and lay, you know, 14,000 to 3 million eggs. So these fish get smart over time. The 24-inch stripers are the youngest, they're the quickest, they're the fastest, and they're naive. As we get into the 5-year stripers, the 7-year stripers, the 15-year stripers, they're smarter. So what I'll use is very stealthy, very thin leaders. I'll use sand eel patterns that are light, in light water, but as I go into the heavier water, we'll use the grain lines, the 250, 300. I don't think you need anything more than 300. I mean, some guys will get into 400 to 500, but man, that rip's gotta be going like wicked quick, and, those things are tough to cast.
Are you talking about shooting heads or?
Yeah, Roger, it's exactly like a shooting head. It can be whatever length the angler wants, but you're trying to get it to the depth of the fish. The problem is when you're trying to get that off of a boat or whatever you're doing, you're stripping your line back to the boat. Say I'm on the bow of Robbie's boat and I'm stripping back and I've got 400 grain line. Well, I've got to think about my next cast. And my next cast with a 450 grain versus a 250 grain is a lot easier to get back out there. Another thing that's really, really important with striper fishing, as far as, I mean, we're talking about stripping for stripers, there's a technique I use. I strip, 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 strip. If I kept stripping either on a boat or on a point of land or on the beach and I strip my fly all the way back to the tip of my fly rod, well, I'm out of line for the next cast. So what I'll do is I'll strip, 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 and I'll have an optimum level of line in the water, and I'll move my rod back, okay, behind my body. And if everybody can visualize this, I'm moving my rod back, and then I'll roll my line out, pick up, and then I'll cast. Now, what I'm doing is I'm dancing the fly in front of my feet. Okay, I've had stripers hundreds of times take my fly 2 feet in front of my feet.
Hmm.
If you think about that, that's an amazing thing, because you're dancing it, and then you're going to roll, pick up, to go back out.
Are you kind of doing a roll cast then? Is that what you're describing?
Absolutely. But what you're trying to do is you're using all your water coming back to you. You're keeping the fly in the water for the maximum amount of time.
Without actually retrieving it. Yeah.
I mean, you know the trick, Roger. It's like you know the guy that false casts a million times over the trout. Well, that's kind of it'll spook them. So you want to go cross cast. Instead of going cross cast, I'll strip, 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 strip into my basket, but then I'll bring my rod behind my body. Now what I do is I've got a lot of line ready to create energy off the water, and I'll roll, I'll pick up, and then I'll cast it right back out. And the stripe, you know, I'm not spooking any water in front of me doing that.
Yeah. Okay, so let me try to get this straight. In the estuaries, you said you were using floating line.
Absolutely.
But if you're in the surf zone, what kind of line are you using then?
In the surf zone, definitely using floating line, because usually stuff's getting pushed up in the surf zone. Now, there's also another line called the intermediate, which is it's kind of a hybrid between the two, like between the sinking line and the floating line. And intermediate drops just a little bit. It's a little bit more. The most popular line right now on the Cape is like an intermediate line that's like gin clear. You can't even see the damn thing. You cast back behind you. And you can't see your loops, but when the line goes on the water, it just looks like mono straight from the reel all the way out to the fly. And that's very popular.
That's very popular out here for lake fishing as well. Yeah.
Exactly. Same thing.
Okay. So no sinking tips then. It's either floating
sinking
or intermediate.
Okay. No, that's not true. Roger, when I'm on a jetty, and now the south side of Cape Cod from Chatham all the way through Harwich, through Dennis, through Yarmouth, through Hyannis, Mashpee, and all out of Falmouth, there's a slew of jetties that are all the way across the south side of the Cape. A shooting tip in the jetty action is amazing, because what you're going to do is, any jetty is a grouping of rocks that man built to protect the beaches. But stripers come in at night, or they come in on the incoming tide. They love that. They love all the jetty action. So if I'm a fly fisher, I can walk out literally to any jetty on the south side of the Cape and have some action and have some success, by the way. What I'll do is I'll say, okay, I've got at any given jetty, say I'm in Mashpee or I'm down in Dennis or I'm in Yarmouth. While I'm in Yarmouth, I'm going to walk out on a jetty. I'll start to my left on the clock at 9 o'clock. I'll start 12 o'clock on the jetty, and then I'll go to 3 o'clock. and I'll use that shooting tip line to get maximum distance with my fly rod. I can use a cross body cast, or I can use a, you know, like a more of a power stroke cast in the wind. Whatever I want to do, I can use it. And if I don't get a strike on that jetty, I can walk, you know, an eighth of a mile to the next jetty and hit that. If I don't get anything, another eighth mile, I get another jetty. And I guarantee you, if you do that four times, you'll get a striper on the Cape.
Well, now, you're saying shooting tip. What I was actually asking about is sinking tip.
Well, what I'm, okay, like a 250 grain on the boat. Well, a sinking
tip. You use those
tip
on the boat then rather than the?
Yeah. So say we're on Robbie's boat and we're on the rips of Monomoy, which is Monomoy Island goes from Chatham 12 miles down, actually, I'm sorry, 9 miles down the lighthouse, and then Nantucket is another 7 miles in the gap there. And I'm in a rip situation where the water is outgoing towards the Atlantic. It's actually the tides in Nantucket Sound are pretty interesting because they face the Bay of Fundy and they face New York. It's an interesting tide in Nantucket. It's a little off kilter versus the tide in, say, Cape Ann or North Carolina. The tide's weird here. It faces Bay of Fundy and faces on the, either way or faces New York or the Elizabeth Islands, and it's obviously the earth is round, so you've got to like accommodate for that. All right. Having said that, and the sinking grain question that you asked, 250 sinking grain in the rips is really important. I'll go upstream from the rips, say that the tide's moving from the left to the right or the right to the left, whatever you're doing. I'll cast up, I'll let the fly sink in the rip, and then it'll come across those waiting predators that want to ambush that those bait coming over the shoals.
Okay, great. Now, let's be specific about your leader and tippet and, you know, how you rig up there, what knots you use, what you're comfortable with there.
On a butt section of the fly line, I use either 30 or 40 pound butt section. I'll tie it with a nail knot to the fly line. What I like to do is either do a 6 inch or a 12 inch, depending on the caster. Because all fly casters are different that I've found over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years that I've been doing this. Everybody's a little different. So your butt section, say it's 8 inches. I'll tie a loop knot at the end of my butt. And then I'll take class leaders, whatever they are. They're 2 pound all the way to 20 pound. And I'll loop-to-loop connection that to the butt section. And that works pretty good for me. If you're a real knot guy and you really like to do knots and you're really into that, which sometimes I'll do that, I'll take the 30 pound and then merge it with the 25 pound, then go down to 15 pound and then go really light at the end, and I'll use blood knots in all that way. I don't.
But normally you just go the loop to loop with your leader and then
directly to the fly? Yeah, I like loop to loop for the estuaries. And I'm in a stealthy situation with a little really light. There's a Monomoy flat wing fly that's super light, that has a great turnover, that with those type of class tippets is amazing. There's a sand eel fly, like a little epoxy sand eel with a little eye that has a great turnover. But if I'm going to be getting to the weighted flies or some heavier flies or some flies that represent herring patterns that are really long, then I might use that heavier stuff and the blood knots to help me with turnover. Some people on the Cape, the old school guys, they just took 40 pound or 30 pound mono and went straight out from their fly line, and that was fine. And you'd be surprised at the simplicity of the flies that they use. Very sparse patterns. You know, you're talking like beer cans and cigarette butts that are slamming bluefish. I would love to get Robbie Briggs on some of this old bluefish action and kind of talk about that a little bit. Can we do that?
Well, I want to stick with stripers here. I don't want to get.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, how about stripers with that? Those old school patterns. You know, those old Cape Cod flies that are, you know, like the Brooks Blonde and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Sure.
Why don't we talk about the different flies and patterns? Let's move to that. Well, let me take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk to Robbie Briggs about fly patterns. So hold tight, folks, and we'll be right back. Fly tires, are you looking for better thread control when you're tying up those number 20 parachute atoms or spinning deer hair? Are you breaking thread tightening down those big saltwater streamers? The right bobbin is your answer. That's RITE bobbin. It's the only adjustable thread tension bobbin on the market today. Just dial in the tension 1 ounce at a time and kiss broken thread goodbye. Professionals, fly tires worldwide are enjoying perfect thread control for all their patterns. For details, go to the website www.RITEBobbins.com. RITEBobbins.com. Wright Bobbins, sold at dealers worldwide. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Michael Mullaney about stripping for stripers. If you'd like to ask Michael a question, just go to our homepage and askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them on the show tonight as possible. Okay, Robbie, let's talk about flies. Tell me what's your go-to fly for a striper. Let's start there.
Well, let me just say that I have changed so much. I used to fly fish at night for stripers with a couple of my teachers way back in high school, which was a lot longer ago than I like to admit. Back before Crystal Flash and Flashaboo and all that, when it was basically a white yarn body and some white and green bucktail. And now we've come up, there's so many excellent patterns out there. And a lot of them depend on, I think, the tires, if you're going to tie your own, your level of skill. One of my favorite flies is really, I have no idea what to call it, it's tied. It's basically four white feathers on a hook, maybe a little crystal flashing with it, and an olive tackle tied around the front of it. And I tie it more like a Keys Tarpon style toward the rear of the hook. And I've had great, great success with that fly, and it's just as simple as could be.
Hmm. Now, do you use short shanked hooks? What style hooks do you use?
Yeah, I'm tying on a short shank hook. I know Michael had mentioned some bluefish. I know this is about stripers, but when the bluefish show up, what I do is I go to like a 3X long shank and do the same thing and I use crinkle nylon instead of the bucktail to defeat the teeth. And it's just basically some crinkle nylon tied on the back of the hook like that, and that gives you that hook shank. You don't always have to have the Wailita.
Okay. But now that was for bluefish, but for stripers,
yeah.
Do you need a bite tippet of any kind for stripers?
Maybe if you're looking to fish down around the 4 and 6 pound tippet range, but generally, no. The stripers I find, you generally get them in the lip somewhere. If they do swallow it, their mouth is, I know like Mike said before, it's just like rough sandpaper in there, a lot like a largemouth bass. If you use anything 10 pound and up, you don't really need a bite tippet.
Okay. So what are the other patterns? The pattern you described is your own personal pattern.
Right.
What are some of the more conventional ones that people would know or could find in books and so forth?
Right. The Clouser minnows.
Good old Clouser, huh?
The good old Clouser. I mean, you can say what you want, but they sure do work. You know, as long as you're not casting them into the back of your head in the wind and stuff, because they hurt a lot, and don't ask me how I know that. And go up to the little bit bulkier flies, like right now we have the peanut bunker starting to show up, and that way that's your deceiver-style flies, a little bit more bulky, a little bigger. Also now there's so many patterns that imitate sand eels that use all this fancy new tubing and like that. A very sparse fly will imitate a sand eel quite well with a little bit of bucktail and a few peacock curls tied on top of it to give it that greenish back. And you don't really, you know, like I said, when you get into the deceiver patterns, now you're getting a little bit more bulkier fly and it's a little bigger profile. That tends to work better in the fall, I find, when you have a lot of peanut bunker around in the water. But the sand eel patterns, there's so many things now, all the fancy tubing and everything. Some tires can get as fancy. You can't hardly tell the difference between a live sand eel and a fly. And I know some gentlemen that just dead drift those. as opposed to moving it. But
so you really have to be tuned up on what is, you know, what kind of bait fish is in, and I take
absolutely.
It that's seasonal as well, right?
I find stripe is more than any other kind of fish can be so tuned into a certain bait that they'll ignore something that they just were eating 2 weeks ago.
Sounds like trout. You know?
Yeah, they can be. They can be. It can be maddening. You know, right now there's a lot of little tiny herring, little tiny squid, and I'm talking about an inch long, and small crabs coming through the rips. I do a lot of my fishing out around Monomoy and the rips just off the end of Monomoy. And I'm drifting in the boat with the motor off so it's quiet. And it's 6 feet of water. You can't run the motor over stretches very much. They're going to disappear. And when you're doing that, you know, then you get the fish coming up. And I like to look every once in a while. I have clients that like to eat striper. They're a great eating fish. You know, so I'm always checking when I fillet the fish farm. I always check the stomach to see what's going on because that gives you a clue as to which flies you should be using.
Yeah, you don't get that opportunity a lot anymore when you're doing catch and release. But when you do get it, then I guess you take advantage of it, right? Yeah, we have a question here from Bob Teeden in Smithfield, Rhode Island. And
yeah.
He asks, do you think we as striper fishermen should avoid using tackle that is too light? I personally use the heaviest tackle I can in the event that I do hook a good-sized fish. And I think what he's referring to is you know, one that you plan on releasing to try to get them in as quickly as possible. What's your take on that, Robbie?
I see a lot of that. Not only do I have a lot of fly fishing clients, but I have a lot of people that use light spinning gear. And there is I've done several seminars in Cabela's down in Pennsylvania and also for the Rhode Island saltwater anglers. And, yeah, light tackle can go too light. You're talking – we live in an area here on Cape Cod where – like we've had three stripers that weighed 73 pounds caught, you know, Nantucket, Cutty Hunk, and Nauset Beach. You don't know the next cast could be a fish that weighs 60 or 70 pounds. And if you want to drop down, you know, guys using 4 and 6 pound tippets, I think that they're going to kill a lot more fish than a guy using slightly heavier tackle and being ready for that big fish. Yeah, it might only be schoolies in the spring, but you can play a schoolie too long as well. I feel like if you drop down to that, what I call that super lightweight, under 10-pound test, say, tippets, I mean, you'd stand in a good chance of, if you get a big fish, that you're pretty much going to kill that fish on the way, and it's going to come in belly up.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I'm glad you.
I mean, I've had
filled us in on that. It's a common problem everywhere, and especially with these larger fish that can really outmuscle us, let's put it that way, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you how, let me relate a story. I tell this to a lot of my customers just when the fishing's a little bit slower and everything, just to let them know. I mean, my best bass is not a huge one. It was 51 pounds. I caught the first cast of the night, I caught a 19-inch fish. The second cast, I caught the 51-pounder. How do you know?
Yeah, how do you know? Yeah.
You know, you got to be ready for that. If the opportunity is there to catch a large fish, I think that to be ethical, you have to have tackle that would handle that large fish.
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
We had another question from Australia, Ron Williams.
Oh boy.
He wants to know what is the most he asked about flies, lines, and tippets, which we've talked about, but he was being more specific from a kayak or small craft, and maybe you can describe how you guys use kayaks. What kind of water you use kayaks in there?
You know what? For that question, I'm going to give you back to Michael because he's
okay,
more of a kayak expert than I am.
Okay.
And he can really tell you.
All right.
Hey, Rod.
Hi. Yeah, the question was from Australia here, Michael. You know, is there, you know, where do you take kayaks and small craft, and what kind of water do you fish with, and do you use different equipment when you're on a kayak? You know, rods, size rods, tippets, so forth.
When I take fly fishers on the kayak, these trips are like absolutely amazing. I'll plan it on the tide. Say we're going on outgoing tide on Pleasant Bay, and I'll like drift the kayak through all the great striper zones, and we'll go through grass lines and points of structure, and then we'll end up in an area, and people will catch maybe like 20 or 30 stripers in that drift. And then as the tide comes back, we're going to do the same thing, and we're going to wait for the bigger fish to come in with the incoming tide. And what happens is we might get out and walk in like an area and cast some fly lines, and we might cast fly lines in the kayak. I mean, obviously, kayak and the fly line casting, you have to be pretty expert to do that. And you know, I have clients that do that, but I would say you get off in the kayak and cast from a point of land. Another little tidbit is bring with you, you know, a stake or a spear that you stick in the sand, and your kayak can be right next to you. And as the tide's moving off the flat either way, to the left or the right, your kayak's not going to go away. You can cast wherever you want. You can walk down the beach and do whatever you want.
That's never happened to you, has it, Mike?
Absolutely, it's happened to me. put a little weight on the back of your kayak. You know, I mean, you don't have to go buy a big fancy, weight. Go to the local gym and get like, you know, a 10-pound weight, and you know, you can tie it off the back of your kayak and sit right in the zone. Because you know what? I'm going to give everybody. Here's the biggest tidbit of the night. Anywhere in Cape Cod, there is a certain zone where the stripers are going to hang. And once you learn those zones, they're going to come back to that zone every night. They're going to come back to that zone every May or every June or every July. And once you learn that, and you got to do your work now. I mean, I'm not going to just give it to you. You got to go out there and pay your dues. But once you find that zone out, you're going to lay your kayak out, and you're going to be there and catch a lot of fish.
Well, if I learned anything tonight, Michael, that means somewhere where there's water moving in an ambush area, right?
Again, it's tide, moving quick, moving water, and it's structure, and then there's water temperature and opportunity for the stripers, and that's what it's all about. And I'll tell you what, it's moving tide. I mean, when the tide moves, fish want to eat. And wherever you are on the Cape, it's either the outgoing or the incoming. And you know what? It can be different. It can be totally different. And you always got to look up for those signs. I'll give you an example. I was in Harwich about a month ago, and I was kayaking in an estuary. And this is a guy from Australia. And I hope I didn't get eaten by a crocodile from the guy from Australia. But I was hanging out in our estuaries, and those guys probably got those salty crocodiles that always eat my kayak up. But I was kayaking in the estuaries in the Cape, and I'm looking out on the beach, and the estuaries always face the beach, and you got to look at the beach and see what's going on. So I might have my binoculars with me, and I'll look out at the horizon, and I'll just look for activity, and I'll see plovers, I'll see seagulls, I'll see terns, and when those terns start diving in the water, that tells you something. That tells you there's activity going on. And you get on the rhythm of what's going on in nature. And, you know, when those birds start diving, you got the striper's mark. And there could be like 1,000 people on the beach. You know, there's a bunch of kids playing to the left and a bunch of kids playing to the right. And, you know, these fish are doing whatever they're going to do. And once you learn those rhythms, it's really interesting because once you become a fly fisher on Cape Cod, your eyes are always on the water.
Got a question here, Michael, from Tommy L. in Southwest Florida. He says, Michael, I'm lucky to fish Cape Cod twice a year, June and September. Well, I fish the crab fly for redfish down in Florida. How would you suggest presenting the fly to the striped bass? And do you move the fly or wait until the bass is in the eyeball of the fly before moving it? Or do you just leave it for them to find? And I assume he's talking about fishing crab patterns there.
Yeah, that's an amazing question. Okay. The first part of that answer to that question is stripers absolutely act like redfish. Stripers also act like bonefish. They will pot up like bonefish, and they will go across the flats in gray ghost type of thing. They're like the gray ghosts going across. They're like shadows. They're like rats coming in, or whatever you want to call them. They move across the flats like bonefish do, and the experienced guide sitting on the platform can see that, and the guy that goes out there for the first day, the It's like, what just happened? And then after the second day, the guest or the client's like, okay, now I get it. I can see those guys. All right? Stripers act exactly like that. And we'll get back to the crab question in a second. Stripers also act like redfish. They go into the muckiest of the muckiest of the estuary. They'll go in there and they'll tail in the estuaries. They'll root around. And maybe you'll just see a little bit of shine, a little bit of glimpse, a little bit of like, maybe you didn't even see it, but you thought you saw it. And you're like, where's that redfish? Where's that beautiful gold thing? Well, stripers act the same way. And stripers actually change colors, by the way. So they will mirror the sandy bottom, wherever they are, or they'll become gin clear, or they'll become like greeny, or they'll become like blue. So you're looking, you're like, wait a second, was that a striper or was that a bluefish? And you're like, my God, that is a striped bass. Okay, so what you're going to be doing is you're going to be like throwing that crab pattern out. And what I think is it's not like live bait. And if I'm like a live bait crab guy and I'm fishing for permit or I'm fishing for stripers or I'm going to hook a live bait or a lobster, by the way. We're in New England and stripers down on lobsters. I want that thing to twitch and move. So the answer to that question, I know it's been a long-winded discussion, but I think you got to move that thing. You got to twitch that thing. I don't think you can leave it. I don't agree with that. Leaving a fly just sitting there, unless you know, you got to move it. And you got to twitch it.
Yeah, got to give it some natural movement.
Right? Absolutely.
But when
we're mirroring live bait. I mean, that's what we do. You know.
Yeah. You brought up some thoughts for me here. When you said it's like redfish or like bonefish. You know, bonefish are very spooky in schools and so forth, and you can throw off the whole school if your cast is wrong or you kerplunk a big fly down on them. What about stripers? Are they spooky like that? How is your approach to a school? Do you cast ahead of them, into the middle? What's your approach?
All right, on the Brewster Flats, which is Brewster and Dennis, the Cape Guy goes from Provincetown, it goes to Truro, Wellfleet, and this is from a point, by the way. All right, we'll start again. It goes P-Town, Provincetown, Truro, Wellfleet, East Ham, Orleans, then Chatham's the Elbow, and then it starts going towards the mainland, which is Brewster, Harwich, Dennis, Yarmouth, Hyannis, Mashpee, Falmouth, and Sandwich. Those are the 14 towns here. Okay, on the Brewster Flats, which is the Dennis-Brewster border on the north side, we can answer that question about presentation. What I would say is that you throw the fly out, you know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, the fish move in pods in the Brewster Flats. It's like, all right, you ready for the next, the second biggest helpful thing for tonight?
Okay. Right.
Within any flats, there's a river. Okay? In a flats area, there's a river. Wherever you are, there's a river. And everybody's got to concentrate on this for a second. In the ocean, there's rivers and there's tidal things. And you're like, oh my God, what do you mean by a river? And they're like, you're like, what are you guys talking about in the Cape Cod? What is a river? I mean, you know the Mississippi River, you know, any type of river. On the flats, a river is a tidal movement that goes through stagnant water on the left or the right, but there is a movement in the river on the flat. That river could be 20 yards to the left or 20 yards to the right. And at low tide, you can find those rivers. It's like a marking point.
Sure.
As the water comes in or comes out, those where the fish are going to hang. So at any flat you are, there could be a guy that's fishing a quarter mile to your left, a quarter mile right, but the guy that knows that fishery is going to be in that river of Nirvana.
Okay. But back to the spookiness of the pods of fish. What are they spooky like bonefish, or do they care about the cast?
All right. Say you're at low tide, and you've got a pod of stripers coming through like the bonefish do in these rivers. The water drops, like on the Cape Cod Bay side, the water drops at least a mile. It's 9 feet drop. And as that water drops in the low tide, it exposes all the grassy areas and the structure of sluiceways. Those fish are moving in and out of those sluiceways, and if you've got your boat, your flat-style boat, and you're casting upon these fish, like bonefish, you're definitely going to spook them, for sure. But the key is to understand that there are sluiceways in the rivers in like 2 or 3 football fields worth of water, wherever you are. You got to find that river within the ocean, and that's kind of cool because a lot of people don't understand that. And you can go out in the water and just do whatever you're going to be doing.
Okay.
And
they're in that. I get the water movement situation, but where are you casting to these pods? Are you casting ahead of them? Are they moving to your fly, or are you moving your fly to them? What?
You're casting ahead of them for sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
and as with most saltwater fish, you probably prefer to pull that fly away from them rather than at them, right?
Stripers are pretty aggressive, and the sight lines that they have, they're predators, and they were born to be predators. And any striper that's a decent weight, you know, a 30-incher or 40-incher, those guys are, you know, very voracious. They're gonna go after that fly. Like a bat out of hell, and they're gonna move right on it. And when you get a, I'll give you an example. I had 2 7-weight rods over the last 3 seasons. Both of them got smashed by 20-inch stripers, broke in half.
So the take is aggressive.
Yeah, I mean,
and the fight is good.
Aggressive. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, we're running out of time here, and as usual, we've, you know, got plenty of questions left, but no time left. So we'll have to kind of wrap things up here. But why don't you quickly tell if a person was, because it's a little different out where you are as other parts of the world. If a person was going to take a trip out there, what kind of opportunities are there? Is there camping? Do you stay in a lodge? Do you stay in a hotel? How would they approach setting up a trip to come out to the Cape?
Well, Providence Airport in Rhode Island is the most affordable. It's about an hour drive. We'll limo you in to the Cape, no problem. And Logan Airport from Boston is about an hour and a half up, and that's another great airport. We'll pick you up in the airport. We'll bring you down to any type of hotel experience that you want, whether it's a 5-diamond resort on the water or just a motel that is affordable. We'll do it all.
Okay, so most of the places you're going to stay are going to be hotels rather than the lodges you would think of out west or the resorts that you should think of down in the Caribbean, right? You're kind of staying in town.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because the Cape is very unique. You can be 10 minutes into that type of Bahamas experience, and then you can be in downtown Hyannis and get the nightlife.
Okay.
You definitely can have that blue water experience in the Cape that you're looking for. And it is accessible. That's the amazing part about it. I mean, obviously we're smack middle from Boston down to DC, and the demographics are interesting, but Cape Cod is still, you know, 90 miles out into the Atlantic. I mean, the only part of the East Coast that's even farther out into the eastern seaboard than us is North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what? Northern Maine as well. And, you know, that is all beautiful, clean water that's coming through. We got the most best oysters there are. I mean, this is the clamming, you know.
Yeah, speaking of that, if a person wanted to do some camping, are there campgrounds on the beach there that you could stay a few days at?
Absolutely. You can do a campground situation. You know what you else can do, Roger? You can do lobstering. You can come out and go on the boat. How about this? How about you catch some stripers for 2 hours, and you go catch a lobster for the next 2 hours? How crazy is that?
Sounds good. Well, time's out here, and we've got to kind of close things up, so hang tight there just for a few minutes, and I've got a few things to go through, Michael, and if you could just maintain the silence on that end while I go through these things, it'd be great. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. Keeney's Fly Shop has an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. Well, from our global events calendar, we see that on Saturday, September 8th, 2007, on the Lower American River in Sacramento, California, Keeney's Fly Shop will be hosting the Fall Spay Day at Watt Avenue. Demos, they're going to have demos from 9 a.m. till noon with open casting and discussion after Mike McCoon demonstrates Skagit. Jeff Putnam will be demonstrating Getting Started in the Space Tune-Up. Darren Elmo with Sage Rod Company will be there with Sage's new lineup of two-handed and switch rods for everyone to try. So this should be a great event to kick off the fall steelhead season. It's a free event, so bring anyone you might want that might be interested in two-handed casting. So to see this and to get more information, just go to our global events calendar on our website. Link is at the bottom of every page of our site and look under the U.S. and then California for more information. Fly shops and clubs, you can list all your fly fishing related events on the global events calendar. It's free. You can do it yourself. Go to the events calendar and get started. Get your events out there for everyone to see. Classes, demos, clinics, shows, schools, anything related to fly fishing. We'll be highlighting one event from the calendar on each of our shows. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone tonight, before you leave our website, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine, both outstanding resources to learn about fly fishing and to participate in volunteer efforts and so forth. The winners of our drawing are randomly selected from our show's database. If you didn't register yet for tonight's show, it's a little late, but you can make sure you do so for the next show. You don't want to miss out on any of the nice prizes that we have to offer on each show. But if you are the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your gift. And then we'll get that out to you then. So I am going to do the drawing here, first of all, for the Federation of Fly Fishing membership, 3-year membership. And I'm going to press my magic button here and see who we come up with. And it is Rod Zeller in Pennsylvania. Rod Zeller in Pennsylvania. So congratulations, Rod, on winning that 3-year membership to the FFF. And then we'll pick another winner for Fly Fusion Magazine. Fly Fusion Magazine is out of Calgary, Canada, but serves both Canadian and U.S. Readers. Great resource for learning about it. And that would be Heather Palmer. Heather Palmer in South Dakota won that subscription. So congratulations, Rod. Congratulations, Heather. Hope you enjoy with these great gifts. Well, Michael, we really appreciate you and Robbie for being on the show tonight. Surely enjoyed it. Thanks for taking time with sharing your experience and knowledge with us about striped bass and fishing for striped bass in the Cape Cod area. And hopefully we can maybe talk about one of the other kinds of fish that I know you've got a lot to fish for up in that area.
Thank you so much, Roger. I mean, I hope I did a great job.
We did. You passed on a lot of information tonight, and I'm sure folks learned a lot. So.
Yeah, Roger, this sport is amazing. It's just, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome. Well, on our next broadcast, which will be on September 5th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern, we're going to be interviewing Captain Bob Jaspers, and our topic for the show will be sight fishing the flats of Indian Lagoon. Learn from Bob Jaspers the secrets of sight fishing the flats of Indian River Lagoon, Mosquito Lagoon, and the Banana River's No Motor Zone. This area is a premier angling destination for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum. There's nothing more exciting than sight fishing in shallow water. We'd like to thank Flats Time Charters, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Wright Bobbins, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. And feel free to explore the other areas of our site like the events calendar and the directories. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.